Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The daily lives of Syrians have dramatically changed since March 2011, when protests against the regime of Bashar al-Assad began in the southern city of Daraa. What began as a movement of peaceful protests demanding regime change and political reforms has morphed into one of the most brutal and horrific conflicts in the post-World War II era. The humanitarian costs of the Syrian conflict have been staggering. Many, including officials at the UN, say that this is the worst humanitarian crisis of our time. More than 200,000 Syrians have been killed, 8 million have been internally displaced, 4 million are refugees, and close to 650,000 have been cut off from humanitarian access. Syria's struggling population continues to dwindle as lives are lost to war and hunger. So on today's Your Call, we are spending the hour talking about the horrific war in Syria. In his new book, Syria, today's guest, Professor Samer Aboud, writes, quote, "The human tragedy of the Syrian conflict has no current end in sight. Sadly, and much to the detriment of Syrian society for generations to come, many local and regional actors seem content to fuel the horrors of the violence and do not invest in a meaningful process that could end the conflict. From the Syrian regime itself, which bears ultimate culpability and responsibility for the descent into maddening violence, to the various rebel groups, to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and Iran, there is seemingly no interest in ending this conflict," end quote. So what will it take to stop this bloodshed? Today we're joined by Samer Aboud. He's Associate Professor of History and International Studies at Arcadia University. His new book is called Syria, and he joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Hi, Samer. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you very much for having me again.
Well, it is really nice to have you. I'm glad we're going to spend the hour on this. In your book, you write that it is with tremendous sadness that you have to have written this book, which for you has been akin to recalling and retelling a very tragic story that has played out for years right before you, your eyes. And you say that, like you and so many others, you're wandering helplessly trying to make sense of what's happening. And you argue that the world has watched with ambivalence, befitting a weather report. And you say that there's a lot of confusion surrounding Syria. And now that it is getting so much media attention, do you still feel like there's a lot of confusion?
I do. I think that this is a multi-layered, it's a conflict, it's a complicated conflict. And I think that what we want to do, especially in the United States, is to try and reduce the conflict into knowable terms, good guys, bad guys, you know, that sort of stuff, so that we can begin to understand it. But as the conflict now enters its sixth year, what's happening is that there are more actors getting involved, both inside of Syria and outside of Syria. There are more issues at play. The humanitarian crisis is worsening, meaning that the response to the crisis needs to be thought of in generational terms, and I think that while the conflict is deepening, we're still trying to put it into these very narrow pegs that make it knowable for us. So we want to know who should we support in the U.S., for example, who's the lesser evil, what poison should we drink, these sorts of questions. And I think that this really clouds our understanding of what's happening inside of Syria, and ultimately prevents us from answering those questions in serious and substantive ways.
Well, and it's definitely been simplified if you watch the presidential debates and hear the candidates
Absolutely.
Talk about Syria and ISIS. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the bigger picture here. Talk about what you think needs more discussion at this point.
That's a great question. Right now, with the diplomatic rift between Saudi Arabia and Iran, everyone's attention is on what the impacts that will have on the Syrian peace process that's supposed to begin at the end of the month. And while I think that's important, I think it's problematic because it assumes that the answer to the Syrian conflict is solely outside of the country. There's a very serious question about whether the international actors, Russia, Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, who are the major ones right now, actually have the ability to agree first outside of Syria and then to implement that agreement inside of the country. The country is full of militias at this point. There's over 1,000 militias. And to assume that the countries that are supporting them or providing them material support or ideological support, to assume that they can simply turn the tap on or off and have these rebel groups do what they want is problematic. And I don't think it's the case. I don't think that's how the Syrian conflict has developed. So I think that this increasing attention and the kind of putting our eggs all in the basket of getting the Iranians and the Saudis to talk to each other and to agree and then that would somehow solve the conflict is problematic. We have to look at what's happening inside of Syria. We have to look at what's happening on the very local levels. And I'm not talking just about cities like Aleppo, what's happening in Aleppo, or what's happening in Damascus, but even to the point of looking at what's happening within these neighborhoods. We have massive ethnic cleansing, if we can call it that, inside of Syria. It's more kind of along the lines of sectarian cleansing. You have entire neighborhoods that are being cleansed of their inhabitants in order for combatants to come in and take them over. You also have, and this is something that we simply don't talk about, you have the establishment of a war economy inside of Syria, where most of the violence now is not being committed in the name of some sort of meta-sectarian conflict, which is the way we want to understand it. But the violence is being committed in order to control supply routes or to control access to highways, to control taxation on humanitarian convoys and things like that. So the conflict actually has an internal logic that is beyond the sectarian way in which we framed it here in the West.
And we have spoken to a number of journalists who have said it is almost impossible to go to Syria at this point. There are some humanitarian groups that post regularly on social media. How are you getting your information about what's actually happening inside of Syria?
That's a really great question, and as a as an academic, it's one that we contemplate all the time. And I think you alluded to my answer, which is that social media has been extremely important. One of the problems with the Syrian conflict, or trying to understand it and trying to make sense of it, is that it's happening live. So the answers that I give today will be different than the ones that I might give in a year based on developments within the conflict. In the meantime, in trying to make sense of it, we have to go to the sources that are reporting on a daily basis. So a lot of citizen journalists within Syria are very accessible over social media. That's been extremely beneficial. A number of humanitarian organizations publish things like maps, which are also very helpful because they give us a sense of the supply routes. Some of them have even published information about which rebel groups control which checkpoints and which areas. And that gives us a sense of who the more materially powerful rebel groups are inside of Syria. So what we're trying to do as, whether as journalists or academics or observers of the Syrian conflict, is trying to catch something or to capture something that's happening really moment by moment. And I have to say, personally, I've benefited tremendously from the social media presence of a lot of both the humanitarian organizations and the citizen journalists, but also talking to people inside of Syria. I still have some family members inside of Syria who I try to talk to, not as regularly as I probably should, but I try. And then also many of my Syrian friends who've left the country and who remain in touch with their families and their friends.
And so, Samer, what are you hearing from your family members who are still inside Syria? I mean, what is it like, daily life like, for people who are still there?
Well, we're very fortunate that my family has what we would consider here middle-class resources and is still able to survive and to access goods on the market. You know, they still have food. They refuse to leave, which, to be completely honest and be a bit personal, I can't quite understand, because they do have the resources to leave. Mm. Many other people are really stuck. I think that there's this deep desire that the conflict is going to end soon. I think a lot of that is wishful thinking. I had one friend of mine who told me this awful story about his father, who had to spend almost 6 months sleeping inside of his shop because there were so many checkpoints around his house that he was scared to go back home and to basically be stuck on the other side of the checkpoints. And I think that that kind of fear and that kind of insecurity that Syrians live with on a daily basis makes it very difficult for them, whether they are of the kind of middle class or not. I think it makes it very difficult for them to contemplate something or a life, sorry, outside of Syria. I think that their needs are very immediate. And when I think of that, I can't help but think of what's happening to the people who are actually leaving the country. What is the decision-making process for many of them? Because I have not just family, but many friends whose parents have had the resources to leave or whose sisters and brothers have had the resources to leave and have refused. Hmm. They've actively refused. But they're also living in these conditions where their mobility is bound by checkpoints, where the cost of living is increasing at a very rapid pace. They're becoming dependent on remittances. Even getting medicine has become very difficult. You know, many of us will try to send material or to anything from I've sent cameras, if you can believe it, digital cameras to friends, but also medicine. But now this is through Lebanon, of course, for people going back and forth. But now it's actually well known that sending medicine is subject to getting confiscated because medicine has become very scarce. So a lot of the armed, armed regime authorities on the border or at the checkpoints going to Damascus will actually confiscate the medicine because they can sell it on the black market. So this is the daily situation that people are living with, and there's not just uncertainty inside of Syria. There's uncertainty outside of it. Many of them are looking at, the lead-in to our conversation was about a boat capsizing and at least 34 Syrian refugees dying in the Mediterranean. This is the lead-in to our discussion, and Syrians are seeing this happen. They're seeing what's happening to people inside of Lebanon, where there are curfews being imposed on them by armed Lebanese, where things have become very difficult for people inside of Turkey, which is still the best place for I think for Syrians in the region. They see Syrians in the camps in Zaatari, and I think that they're not willing to trade the uncertainty of life in Syria for the uncertainty of life outside of it.
I'm speaking with Samer Aboud. He is out with a new book called Syria. Samer is Associate Professor of History and International Studies at Arcadia University. And we are talking about the horrific conflict in Syria. More than 200,000 Syrians have been killed. 8 million have been internally displaced. 4 million are refugees. And if you have any questions about Syria, about how we got here and what is next, about the refugee crisis, we're actually going to do an entire show on the refugee crisis in the coming weeks. We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. As Samer mentioned, this conflict is very simplified in a lot of coverage in the United States, especially when you look at how it is covered with the presidential campaign, the questions that are asked, the rhetoric coming from these candidates. It's very simplified. And so if you have questions about the complexities, the various actors involved, we'd love to hear from you. And then also we really want to talk about just how people are dealing with this, people who are still living in Syria, people who are trying to leave Syria. And what are your thoughts about the role the U.S. is playing or should play? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So just to talk a little bit more about the people who are still in Syria, you say there are 1,000 militias there. So how does that affect how people move? Do they have to move between various conflict zones? What does that look like?
Yes. So that's an excellent question. I think that the question speaks to the internal problems, internal issues of the conflict. There are checkpoints. There are what we would consider maybe mobile checkpoints. These are people in trucks, in vans, in cars, things like that, that will go along a supply route or will go into an area and just set up a checkpoint. They'll put the cars, they'll block the area, and they'll set up, and they'll use that to either ensure the movement of, say, a leader, a rebel leader, a commander, or a convoy, or anything like that, or they'll do that to tax a population. What we also have, and this is a bit frightening, in Aleppo you have this, in Homs and Hama you had this as well, but less so given the circumstances there. You have permanent checkpoints that are run not just by the regime forces, but by quote-unquote rebel forces as well. And these are permanent, established kind of, you know, brick-and-mortar checkpoints that exist on highways. So if you're a Syrian trying to move from one area to the other, it becomes very difficult. You have to either pay taxes, you have to pay bribes. And this is one of the reasons why many of Syrians, even if they want to leave, will find it very difficult. In 2013, I spoke to a family that came from Aleppo to the Baqa Valley in Lebanon, and they told me at that time, and this is a very informal conversation. I happened to be in the region, and I was talking to them, and they told me that they had passed something like 27 checkpoints
Wow.
on the way from Aleppo to the Baqa. And this was at a time where the conflict was consolidating, especially around Aleppo. That's why they left. The violence was increasing. And now, without having any direct evidence, I'm fairly certain that the number of checkpoints would have proliferated between 2013 and 2015. In fact, all evidence suggests that they've been increasing and not decreasing. And so even if you try and navigate around these permanent checkpoints as a Syrian, you run into the possibility of these mobile checkpoints that are prevalent throughout throughout the cities, on highways, on supply routes. And so really your mobility is limited and dependent on your ability to pay to get through. And even in those cases, as we know, people may still be subject to abduction, to violence. A lot of sexual violence, of course, is occurring against women at these checkpoints and in these circumstances. And so it's very difficult. Even the from the border, from the Lebanese border to Damascus, which is more or less controlled by the regime, even those highways, even that area, which are controlled by regime-affiliated armed groups, is scary. So even when there's continuity, like let's say I'm only in a Kurdish area, or I'm only in the ISIS areas, or only in the Nusra or regime areas, even there, there's no kind of continuity in the security. One checkpoint may let you go through, the other may charge you. And again, that speaks to the uncertainty. It also speaks to something else that I think we ignore in the conversation around Syria. When we talk about Iran and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Russia, etc., it's almost as if they're the ones committing the violence. Now, in the case of Russia and Iran, yes, they are. They have forces inside of the country. Obviously, there's a Russian bombardment. But who's committing the violence in Syria? There's a foreign component. But a lot of the violence is actually being committed by civilians. And many of these civilians get recruited into the armed groups because of the situation, because of the despair that they're living in, because of the uncertainty, that recruitment into the armed groups is very easy, that the armed groups are able to recruit people who are not mobile, cannot leave the country, don't have the resources to leave the country. There are obviously no prospects for employment. There aren't a lot of material resources. And the armed groups provide this kind of safety net almost in a way, and allows people to provide for themselves and in many cases for their families. So when a thousand militia groups propping up, it's not just simply for, say, ideological reasons, or the Saudis pumped in more money, or this or that, but from it has a lot to do with what's happening on the ground, and that the transition from an individual, or the transition for an individual from being a civilian to a combatant is becoming easier and easier as the conflict goes on.
Samer Aboud is the author of the new book, Syria. And let's take a call before we go to break. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I'd like to ask the guest this question. In a neighboring country in Iraq, a close friend of mine who grew up there and has family there, when we invaded Iraq, he thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread, and Saddam Hussein was going to be overthrown and there'd be democracy, etc., etc. Now he feels it was a complete mistake, there's no electricity, etc., and his family there is suffering. I'm curious with respect to Syria, whether the guest feels that if at the outset of the democracy movement, or however one wants to refer to it, the United States had stayed out and hadn't given any aid to anybody, and nobody had given any aid to anybody, and Saddam and Assad had defeated the uprising completely, would at this time, so distant from that time, would Syrians have been living better or worse than they're living at this time?
Thank you, William, for that question. I think the to begin with the issue of Iraq, at the time, the Iraqis inside and outside of the country had gone through a generation of sanctions, war, Iran-Iraq war, first Gulf War, sanctions, and then, of course, the kind of daily repression of living under Saddam Hussein's regime. And so I think that we can't fault Iraqis for thinking at the time that his removal would be a good thing. What is problematic is the assumption that the removal would be managed properly, or that the U.S. had some sort of right even to make that decision for Iraqis when barely a decade before they had stood in the way of Iraqis revolting against Saddam Hussein. In terms of Syria, it's very difficult to tell what would have happened under different scenarios. What I do know is that the United States from the very beginning has had a kind of kick the can approach, or kick the tires, you know, just kind of, let's see what happens and nothing. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the administration has refused to understand the complexity of this conflict and has refused to even frame it from the very beginning in a serious way as an uprising against a dictatorship that has been in the country for decades and decades. And if the United States had, or at least if this administration had given itself more options than arming the rebels, for example, or not arming the rebels, they could have seriously supported the democratic movement, the nonviolent movement, and placed enough political pressure on the regime and on other regional actors in order to come up with a solution that doesn't lead to, or that didn't lead to what we're seeing now. Of course, many Syrians, William, you're raising a really interesting point. Many Syrians right now are asking themselves, was it worth it? This is a very serious question. Was it worth it to go and to protest? I have friends who fall very strongly on the side of no, it was not worth it. And I have other friends who say, well, you know, it's too late. You know, we've made the choice. We made the choice. We suffered. And now we can't stop. We have to go through with this. So we have to rescue the uprising, both from the regime, from the international powers, and from the rebel groups. So I think engaging in the kind of hypothetical question of what would have happened is challenging, but I think it's an important question that many Syrians are debating amongst themselves right now.
And Samer, you said that the United States could have supported the uprising. Can you elaborate on that? What would you have liked to see?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm generally speaking in favor of U.S. disengagement, of course. I think that the United States has its hands all over the region, not just in Iraq and not just in the occupation of Iraq and its aftermath, but throughout the region. And I think that, you know, the administration sees the region, not just the Obama administration, the Bush administration, of course, before it, sees the administration through this very narrow security prism that is premised on stability, quote unquote, and the stability that the United States imagines for the region, the vision of stability that the administration has for the region, is deeply problematic for the people of the region and contradictory to their interests. And this is why I think we see that the administration has really supported the reactionary forces, the status quo within the region, and was never keen on supporting the democratic forces in any of the countries, whether in Egypt, Bahrain, Tunisia, Syria, anywhere, because the status quo is precisely how this administration defines stability in the region. Again, this is problematic because stability in that sense means oppression, violence, unemployment, despair for the people of the region. And this is precisely why they engaged in the protests and the uprising in the first place. So the United States was from the very beginning on the wrong side of history because it wanted to imagine and to envision the region stability in very particular ways. And that contradicted the visions of the Syrian protesters and all the other protesters in the Arab world. Where have we seen the Obama administration provide a serious commitment to the democratic forces in the Arab world? We did it in 1989. We did it in other years where we very openly, politically, and materially supported democratic movements, democratic trends. And we certainly speak this language and we identify as being the kind of champions of democracy around the world. And I think that this illusion should be put to rest after we see what this administration has done in the Arab world. It's been on the wrong side of history. It supported the counter-revolutionary forces. And in the Syrian case, the United States has not even had a kind of sophisticated humanitarian response. In the early stages of the refugee crisis, Lebanon, 4 million Lebanese with almost 2 million Syrians inside of the country, barely any U.S. money going in there, under the assumption that somehow Hezbollah would, you know, capture the money or something like this. The humanitarian response has been very limited. And so if we can't get the administration to take seriously the refugee crisis, how can we get them to take seriously the democratic movements and the revolutionary forces that started the uprising in Syria? And this has been a problem from day one.
Samer Aboud is Associate Professor of History and International Studies at Arcadia University. He's author of the new book, Syria. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about Syria's descent into civil war? And what's to come in 2016 for Syria? This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways for you to take part in the conversation on Your Call. On the phone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, you may call us toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up in a half an hour here on KALW, it'll be BBC World Have Your Say, BBC News Hour at 2 o'clock this afternoon here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco, your local public radio. Time is 10:34.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with computer scientist Kentaro Toyama about his new book, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. He argues that no technology, however dazzling, can cause social change on its own. What have our gadgets actually accomplished, and what are the best solutions to solve our social challenges? That is tomorrow, and then on Thursday, we will talk about student movements across the country. Today, I am joined by Professor Samer Aboud. He's out with a new book about, it's called Syria, and it's about Syria's descent into civil war. He writes that Syria was once one of the Middle East's most stable states. Today, it is a country on its knees. Samer Aboud is Associate Professor of History and International Studies at Arcadia University. And if you have a question or a comment for Samer, if you'd like to talk about Syria, about the complexities, the various actors involved, the humanitarian crisis. We would love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. If there's something that you don't understand about what is happening in Syria, give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Samer, talking about these militias, the 1,000 militias inside of Syria, who's funding all of these groups?
Great question. At the very beginning, a lot of the funding was coming from private sources in the Gulf. And so Saudi Arabia, for example, the Saudi regime would be funding certain armed groups or certain battalions or brigades of the Free Syrian Army, while many clerics would be funding a lot of the more Islamist-oriented brigades. And so we have to distinguish between public and private funding. A lot of the private funding was coming from the Gulf. A lot of also Syrian expatriates who were based in the Gulf were also funding a lot of the groups. In addition to the funding, Turkey's intelligence apparatus has been essential to the arming of many of these groups because they facilitated the distribution of weapons through the country. So many weapons have come from Libya, from regional black markets, even from Iraq. At the very beginning of the conflict, because of the geography of the conflict and the fact that many rebels had kind of concentrated along the Syrian-Lebanese border, there was a big black market trade occurring between those two countries. And so this is how it kind of started. And one of the ways in which it evolved is that many of the private sources or even the public sources of funding would shift. You know, they'd go from one brigade to another, from one group to another, or it would dry out or dwindle down. And this is, back to an earlier point I made, this is one of the reasons why the war economy in Syria has become so important to the reproduction of the armed groups, that they've had to rely less and less. They become, for many reasons, become more autonomous. Because there's so many of them have become more and more autonomous from the foreign funders, private and public. And many of them may not have the connections with the Turkish intelligence, for example, or may not have black market connections or as strong black market connections to ensure the kind of steady and sustained delivery of weapons. And so what they've had to do is basically rely on the war economy first to get money, to get resources. And second, as I suggested earlier, is a kind of a recruitment mechanism. So to reproduce, these armed groups kind of have to reproduce themselves materially by getting more people, getting more guns, getting more money. And I think that a lot of the foreign support, because the conflict has now gone on for years, has shifted. And so they've had to become more economically less economically dependent on those foreign sources. And they've turned to essentially the Syrian population to receive those funds.
And what about Bashar al-Assad? Over the holidays, I saw a photo of him and his wife with some supporters in Damascus. How has he been able to survive this? And where is he? What role is he playing on a day-to-day basis?
That's a great question. I'm of the opinion, and I think that this is perhaps a minority opinion, but I'm of the opinion that he's actually quite irrelevant to the conflict at this point. I think that the possibility of removing him as ending the conflict, like if we removed him tomorrow, if he, you know, fell down the stairs and died, or if he decided that he was going to give up power and to oversee a transition process, I don't think that stops the fighting. I think that it satisfies very narrow political interests, political demands, of the opposition. I think that it could have some positive impact on people who we would identify as being loyal to the regime. I think many people now have, many supporters of the regime now say, you know, we made a mistake. You know, we thought that they would have been able to solve this, that they would have initiated some sort of political process. So maybe even the camp of people who were loyalists at one point or who remain loyalists, that might satisfy them. but I don't think that it satisfies the armed groups. Consider, for example, the peace process that's supposed to begin next month, that many of the armed groups, many of the more powerful ones, have not agreed to participate. So what if there's a political solution? So what if Bashar al-Assad steps down? Will that impact the fighting? And I think, and perhaps I'm in the minority here, but I think that the answer is no, that I don't think it impacts the fighting in the way in which we would like it to. So I think the opportunity to remove him as a solution to the conflict is long gone. I think this is kind of, excuse me for saying that, kind of so 2012. Hmm. You know, we're beyond the moment where that could end the conflict. And I think, as far as I know, other than the trip to Moscow, which he took on the eve of the beginning of the Russian aerial campaign and ground campaign in Syria, prior to that he went to Moscow. Other than that, I believe that he's just been in Damascus the entire time. The regime has really withered. The decision-making, battlefield decisions are no longer in the hands of Damascus and no longer in the hands of the president. I think that these are decisions that are made on the ground. These are kind of commander-level decisions. And I think that Bashar al-Assad, for this reason, is not as relevant to the battlefield as we would like to think he is.
So what do you think of the argument made by many that Russia's intervention has been primarily about keeping Assad in power?
I think it's actually a very valid claim. And I think that if we see the pattern of Russian involvement in Syria, it certainly suggests this. You know, they're there under the pretext of battling ISIS. Now, this is, you know, everyone is inside of Syria battling ISIS. They're there under the pretext of that. But what they're actually trying to do is eliminate the gray zone between the regime and ISIS and to present the world with this dilemma, with this problem. You know, it's kind of Hitler or Stalin. Who do you want? Do you want the regime? Do you want Bashar al-Assad? The state and its institutions, including the army and the public sector? Or do you want ISIS? What's the choice here? Because the Russian campaign has totally degraded the capacities of the groups that have been fighting both ISIS and the regime. And so by degrading their capacities, they make them less relevant, not just in the battlefield, but also in the political negotiations. And in doing so, slowly, slowly force the world into accepting the regime of Bashar al-Assad as the kind of out, or the preservation of the regime at the very least, as the outcome, as one way to kind of move the conflict out of its current state. And the Russians, we see a lot of kind of little things that are happening inside of the country. For example, they don't cooperate with many of the militias. My understanding is that they're cooperating almost exclusively with the Syrian army because they want to preserve the army as an institution that they can then say, okay, let's take these militiamen, for example, let's take these people in the armed groups and let's integrate them into the army and to present the world with a kind of security sector reform immediately, to present the world with a state and to say, look, we have this state. It's not necessarily what you want, but it's here and it's better than ISIS, and all these other armed groups are willing to demilitarize and to integrate into the army. And so, you know, take it or leave it. And I think that it corresponds to the political campaign being waged by the Russians right now.
Samer Aboud is Associate Professor of History and International Studies at Arcadia. He is out with a new book, Syria, and he argues that the human tragedy of the Syrian conflict has no current end in sight. So what questions do you have about Syria and the various players? If you have any questions about what's actually happening on the ground in Syria, we'll talk a little bit more about that soon. We'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. As Samer argues, this conflict is treated with a very simplistic lens in many cases in the United States, especially when you're talking about the presidential election. So what questions do you have about the various players, about the U.S. role, and what's in store for the future of Syria? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from James in San Francisco. Hi, James. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yes, if your guest could address specific incidents which led to the rebellion 4 years ago? What were the objections, the slogans? And if Syria was such a sophisticated, educated, stable country, what happened? The Assad family has been in power for years. We need some specific background information on what precipitated the rebellion 4 years ago. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, James. That's actually a really interesting question. I think one of the problems that we have is that we refuse to historicize the uprising. We want to see it as if it just started, you know, at the beginning of 2011 without asking about what its background was. So I certainly appreciate the opportunity to provide some background. What had happened in Syria, my explanation for what happened in Syria should be located way back in the 1980s. Essentially, what you had was you had a state that had fiscal resources that it was deriving from oil revenues. It could distribute welfare throughout society. It had a very strong and sophisticated bureaucracy that employed university graduates, for example. There was heavy public investment. Syrian industry was producing very high value-added products, for example, that they were selling to the Soviet Union. And so there was what we would consider development that was occurring in the country in the 70s and 80s. But in the 1980s, there's a fiscal crisis. And the regime slowly has to abandon much of its welfare commitments to Syrian society. And this begins in the 1990s and it accelerates in the 2000s. And really what happens on the eve of the uprising is that you've had two decades, a generation, if you will, where material conditions in the country have consistently degraded, where inequality has not just persisted but has widened. Unemployment has skyrocketed. I'll give you one very, very small example. Maybe it addresses your question about specific examples, but there was an investment law passed in the early 1990s that was supposed to facilitate the entry of investment into the Syrian economy and to enhance employment, to increase employment among Syrians. From 1991 till mid-2000s, the number of projects or the number of jobs that were created under projects licensed by the investment law was 36,000. That's it. In the same time, 2.1 million people entered the labor market. So what you had was a growing population, an increasingly educated population that did not or had no limited employment prospects. So many people were engaged in seasonal work, in informal work. And you had the kind of slow degradation of the socioeconomic conditions in the country. And this paralleled, of course, the presence and persistence of repression throughout the country. I mean, this is a country that had emergency law for more than 40 years. I mean, it was officially repealed at the beginning of the uprising, but in practice wasn't repealed at all. I have a friend of mine who was in prison, 53 times. Mm. And none of it was political. He wasn't engaging in politics. This is a regime that would imprison people for publicly saying things like you can't have economic liberalization without political liberalization. I mean, it was a very, very repressive regime. When the Arab uprisings began, it's no surprise then that the Syrians who protested adopted the common slogan that the people want the downfall of the regime. It's also not surprising that the basis of the uprising was material. It wasn't sectarian. It wasn't ideological. That people were really fed up with increasing inequality in the country, the decrease of any prospects. You know, employment was rampant throughout the country, and this is basically what they were protesting against. And I wish I really had 10 hours to go through this more with you, James. But I'll leave it at this: that the basis of the uprising was economic; it was material. That people had socioeconomic concerns that were not being addressed by the regime. These were national concerns. They weren't happening just in Daraa, where the protests started, or in Damascus. This was happening in the urban areas, the semi-urban areas, the rural areas. It was a national problem. It was a national phenomenon. And for that reason, that's why we see the the outbreak of protests, not just in Daraa, but throughout the country, because there was a kind of common experience of socioeconomic deterioration that people were revolting against. In this country, you know, we have, for all the faults, and there is increasing inequality in this country, we at least have the opportunity to make demands on our elected leaders. Whether that works or not is another question, but we have the ability to write letters, we have the ability to vote people in and out, we do these things. In a country like Syria, on the eve of the uprising, it was very difficult for people to make those kinds of collective demands without facing any repression. And so this is why the political choice is either acquiescence or revolt, that there really wasn't anything in between. And I think that, that's, for me, the immediate background of the conflict. And in a way to deflect from that, this is why the regime cultivated this narrative of the sectarian nature of the conflict. And it became this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy where many of the armed groups now, you know, are jihadist, and we're very far away, at least in the West, from thinking about the Syrian uprising as being an economic uprising, as being about something other than sectarianism. It's very convenient for us to see it as a sectarian conflict, but it never really was.
It's so important to explain all of this because you're talking about a country of about 22 million people, and 22% are between the ages of 15 and 24. And so, what sort of outlets do they have to express their discontent?
Yes, and in the absence of even being able to write letters. You know, some of these are things that we maybe take for granted here. You know, the ability to write elected officials letters, the ability to elect officials from the beginning, and the ability to participate in politics where there is deliberation. And the process of deliberation in Syria was limited to the inner circles of the regime. And this growing segment of society that rose, you know, that's an excellent point. The young people who have ideas about the world, are looking around them and thinking, well, maybe, you know, this isn't the Syria of my parents. This isn't the Syria of my grandparents. Things are not rosy. Things are not good. And I don't have employment prospects. I don't have, there are no political prospects. And what are my outlets? What are my outlets? Emigration is an option. Engaging in politics almost always leads to repression. So what were the options that average Syrians had to articulate their dissatisfaction with the regime, to articulate their desire for a different political system? We know where this led. Nobody got away with these things. These were things that weren't weren't permissible in Syria under Hafez al-Assad or under Bashar al-Assad. If they were jailing professors, the example I used earlier of the person making the demand for economic liberalization along with political liberalization, that was the example of a professor, a full professor in the Department of Economics at the University of Damascus, who was thrown into prison for saying that publicly. This was the situation that people were in, and there was simply no outlet for making political demands.
And this gets lost in this conversation about sort of ISIS versus the West. And you write that from the very beginning of the uprising, the historical suppression of the political opposition, which shaped the limits and possibilities of the protesters and forced them to create new structures from which to organize and mobilize against the regime. I mean, it is amazing that they were able to get that far under all of this oppression. Can you talk about how this peaceful movement became so quickly militarized and the factors that played in that?
It's a remarkable process. What happened initially in Syria is that because of the high levels of repression, any sort of collective organization wasn't possible. So if five of us wanted to get together, if five of us here were frustrated with the American political system or with something that's happening in our cities, we could get together and we could talk about it and we could organize and we could bring people together. And this wouldn't necessarily lead to jail time or to being killed or to being imprisoned or anything like this. In Syria, the prospects of collective organization, of collective action, were limited by the repressive nature of the state. And so when the uprising broke out, these were all people who had to rely on social networks, not political networks, in order to keep the protests going. So, you know, let's bring my father, my mother, my brother, my sister, my cousin, these sorts of things. And the social networks were what initially sustained the political activism in Daraa, especially in Daraa, but in other places. And increasingly, people who had similar political concerns started showing up at these protests. As the regimes, as the police forces, as the security forces, as even the state institutions started to withdraw from these areas, the protesters were forced, I mean, they basically had a mirror. They were looking at a mirror and saying, okay, well, now what? What do we do? And they had to very quickly, within we're talking weeks and months, had to begin to organize society. And to begin to organize along what were essentially revolutionary lines. The problem was that in the absence of material support, and there were many Syrians who provided financial support, material support, whether inside of Syria or outside of Syria, in the absence of kind of institutions or material support, they were eventually crushed under the weight of the presence of the armed groups. So how did the armed groups appear in Syria? It's because there was a political stalemate. Going from 2011 into 2012, despite the fact that the regime was retreating in many areas, despite the fact that you had all of these kind of local councils emerging and you had a political opposition and the Free Syrian Army, there wasn't a lot of coordination between them. So there was the appearance of a kind of national revolution, and that was certainly the case, that it was happening throughout the country, but it wasn't coordinated because those pre-existing relationships that the political networks that we would assume political networks would have simply didn't exist in Syria. And so even moving, say, from Aleppo in the north to Daraa in the south became very difficult for activists because of checkpoints, because of violence, because of regime repression. So a lot of these bodies kind of grew independent of each other.
And Samer, we only have a minute left. There was a really nice story in Al Jazeera about an underground theater in Aleppo. Aleppo actors are inviting people to a secret hiding place to tell stories of hope. Do you have any other rays of hope in Syria that you can point to?
That. I think that's an excellent, that report is an excellent one. No, I saw that as well. I think that for me, the only thing that keeps me personally and politically hopeful at this point is the fact that Syrians have not succumbed to the cancer of the regime and of ISIS and of the armed groups, that there still exists in Syrians the will for a new country.
And Armand writes in, it's very sad to remember that when I was growing up in Damascus, it was a highly educated, exciting, exotic, and cherished place, longing to be visited. Thank you for that, Armand. Today we've been joined by Samer Aboud, Associate Professor of History and International Studies at Arcadia University. Check out his new book called Syria. Samer, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, computer scientist Kentaro Toyama joins us to talk about his new book, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. Toyama argues that no technology, however dazzling, can cause social change on its own. We've seen the explosion of new technologies over the last four decades, yet the rate of poverty persists. So what have our gadgets actually accomplished, and what are the best solutions to solve our social challenges? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.